I'd like to read with you, please, from the book of Deuteronomy and chapter 1. Deuteronomy and chapter 1 and verse 1. These be the words which Moses spoke unto all Israel on this side Jordan in the wilderness, in the plain over against the Red Sea, between Paran and Tophel, and Laban and Hazeroth and Dizahab. Verse 3, and it came to pass in the 40th year, in the 11th month, on the first day of the month, that Moses spoke unto the children of Israel, according unto all that the Lord had given him in commandment unto them. Now, just note then the where we're placed geographically and in time-wise. Moses now is with the children of Israel 40 years after they came out of Egypt. The 11th month would place it perhaps in February in our calendar, in the winter. And it would be just a month or two until Joshua would lead the children of Israel into the promised land. I come over then to chapter 4, and we'll commence reading at verse chapter 4 and verse 5. Behold, I have taught you statutes and judgments, even as the Lord my God commanded me, that ye should do so in the land whither ye go to possess it. Keep therefore and do them, for this is your wisdom and your understanding in the sight of the nations, which shall hear all these statutes and say, surely this great nation is a wise and understanding people. For what nation is there so great, who hath God so nigh unto them, as the Lord our God is in all things that we call upon him for? And what nation is there so great, that hath statutes and judgments so righteous, as all this law which I set before thee this day? Only take heed to thyself, and keep thy soul diligently, lest thou forget the things which thine eyes have seen, and lest they depart from thy heart all the days of thy life. But teach them thy sons, and thy sons' sons, specially the day that thou stoodest before the Lord thy God in Horeb, when the Lord said unto me, gather me the people together, and I will make them hear my words, that they may learn to fear me all the days that they shall live upon the earth, and that they may teach their children. And ye came near and stood under the mountain, and the mountain burned with fire unto the midst of heaven, with darkness, clouds, and thick darkness. And the Lord spake unto you out of the midst of the fire. Ye heard the voice of the words, but saw no similitude, only ye heard a voice. And he declared unto you his covenant, which he commanded you to perform, even 10 commandments, and he wrote them upon 2 tables of stone. Come over, please, and down to verse 32. For ask now of the days that are past, which were before thee, since the day that God created man upon the earth, and ask from the one side of heaven unto the other, whether there hath been any such thing as this great thing is, or hath been heard like it. Did ever people hear the voice of God speaking out of the midst of the fire, as thou hast heard, and live? Or hath God assayed to go and take him a nation from the midst of another nation, by temptations, by signs, and by wonders, and by war, and by a mighty hand, and by a stretched out arm, and by great terrors, according to all that the Lord your God did for you in Egypt before your eyes? Unto thee it was showed, that thou mightest know that the Lord, he is God, there is none else beside him. Come down to chapter 5, please, and verse 1. And Moses called all Israel and said unto them, hear, O Israel, the statutes and judgments which I speak in your ears this day, that ye may learn them and keep and do them. The Lord our God made a covenant with us in Horeb. The Lord made not this covenant with our fathers, but with us, even us, who are all of us here alive this day. The Lord talked with you face to face in the mount out of the midst of the fire. Verse 6, I am the Lord thy God, which brought thee Out of the land of Egypt, from the house of bondage, thou shalt have none other gods before me. And then finally, chapter 6 and verse 4. Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God is one Lord, and thou shalt love the Lord thy God with all thine heart, with all thy soul, and with all thy might. And these words which I command thee this day shall be in thine heart. And we trust that the Lord will bless the reading of his word to us, and I do intend to make some other reference to verses within these chapters that we have read from. The motivation this evening, at least my motivation for speaking on Deuteronomy, arose from a question that was asked of me recently by our Bible class. We put it out to them that they could ask whatever questions they liked, and in the new year, in the will of God this year, we'll seek to try to answer them. And one of the questions that was asked was this: why does it seem that the God of the Old Testament is different to the God of the New Testament? And in particular, they made reference to some verses in Deuteronomy where God commands the nation of Israel to go in to Canaan. When they go into Canaan, they were to destroy the people. And I suppose what lay behind the question was the thought that this seemed like genocide. And it's a question that is often raised by atheists seeking to discredit the Bible and say, more or less, why would you want to serve a God like that, that seemed to condone the annihilation of peoples from Canaan? And I must admit, when I thought about it, of course, my initial reaction is, as you would all do, the God of the Old Testament is the God of the New Testament. There is no difference. But in thinking about it and even examining my own heart and conscience, I perhaps had unconsciously, maybe at times, nearly thought the same. You see, when you come to the New Testament and you read that we're not under law but under grace, that there can be a sense in which we think that the two realms were so diametrically opposed that it nearly feels at times as though God is dealing in a different way, almost altogether differently, in the Old Testament, and particularly in these books of the law, than he does in the New. And so with that in mind, I started to study Deuteronomy, and I found, I shouldn't say to my astonishment, one should never be astonished, but perhaps to my shame, that I had entirely misrepresented in my own mind the God of the Old Testament. And in particular, this book, Deuteronomy. I think if, when I was younger at least, if somebody had said, we're going to read from Deuteronomy, I think my initial reaction might have been a sense of, oh dear, not Deuteronomy. And it wasn't just because of my ignorance of the book, but at times, and I heard, I must admit, I've heard very, very few sermons ever on the book of Deuteronomy. But if I ever did hear the name Deuteronomy, I think I might have thought, well, this isn't going to be too soul-stirring. And I wonder perhaps if we have, in our own minds at least, or at least mine, placed a book like Deuteronomy, which in terms of its the name or the meaning, really means the law again, or the law repeated, to really assign that to something that's not relevant or not really all that important to us as Christians. But I'm going to suggest to you that actually, as you read through it and consider it, it not only shows us that the God of the Old Testament is the God of the New Testament, but it shows the fundamental value and position that this book has in the Old Testament. In fact, some scholars suggest that Deuteronomy is, and they would use the words, one of the most important books of all the Old Testament to understand, because it's quoted frequently in the New. And if you were to take one practical lessons, if you were to say, for example, yes, well, I want practical Christian living. How do I overcome temptation in a world like this? You might remember that when the Lord was tempted in the wilderness, he quotes three times from the book of Deuteronomy. And if you want to know something about the mercy of God and the love of God, you might be surprised to know that that is found on numerous occasions in the book of Deuteronomy, perhaps the first book really of the Old Testament that deals with the love of God per se. And so it's with that in mind that I want us now to come with a fresh sense of wanting to hear from the lips of Moses as he preaches these final sermons to the nation of Israel. We do well just to stop and try to imagine ourselves with them. As I said, 40 years had passed from when they left Egypt, and now they find themselves on the banks of the Jordan in the plains of Moab. If you have a map, you can find that it's just to the east side of really just where the Jordan comes down to meet the Dead Sea. It probably would have been in eyesight of Jericho on the other side of the Jordan, just a little up the hill from there. And they had amassed now together to listen to Moses preach. If you want to get a sense of this book, just imagine for a moment, Moses knew that these would be his last days with the nation that he had led for 40 years. It's an entirely new generation. We might use the term, these are all young people, not entirely young, but if you were over 60, you would have been just in the company of perhaps Joshua and Caleb and Moses, and I'm not sure if there were too many other above 60. Everybody was a younger generation. There was nobody that would have been over 20 when they came out of Egypt. And in fact, the vast majority of them that stood before Moses had never known Egypt. And all they had known in all their life was just to have wandered through the wilderness for 40 years. And now Moses was going to have one final opportunity to preach to them, to leave within the minds of these young people a sense of the greatness of the God whom they serve, and was going to exhort them and to encourage them. He wouldn't go with them. They were going to go into a land. And if I could put it this way, an enormous amount rested upon their shoulders, to which if you and I were to think about the debt of gratitude we owe to this generation, it's immense. I appreciate you might have a long list of people you'd like to meet when you get to heaven. But make sure on your list is somebody from this generation that were on the plains of Moab, that had in front of them the Jordan, it had in front of them Jericho and the walled cities and the giants that their forefathers, their fathers and their grandfathers, had failed to enter in because of unbelief, as Moses is going to remind them in this first chapter of Deuteronomy. And it was now on their shoulders. And if I could put it humanly speaking, that the future of monotheism, the future of the belief of one God, as opposed to polytheism, which was the world dominant religion at the time. They believed in the pantheon of gods. All the nations had different names for them, but universally all of the nations had a concept of these multiple gods. And here was a group of young people that believed in the one true God. And I'm going to suggest this, the future of humanity and the future of God's purposes for this world rest then in the success or otherwise of this generation. Will they go over? Will they establish the land? Will they raise a standard to the belief in the one true God that has carried on right down through the time since? So Moses has then perhaps a week or two with them before God will take him and bury him in a mountain just behind the plains where they're standing now. And then Joshua will lead them across the Jordan. So you can imagine then the pathos and the sense that must have been in Moses' heart, one final opportunity to preach to a generation to which so much depends upon. Where would he start? How will he do it? Now, if you're just to read some of the scholars, if I could put it in that way, They might tell you that the structure of this book follows very closely with the structures of many treaties that they have found in archaeological evidence that certain kings in the area, whether they were Hittite kings or Canaanite kings, made with vassal states. In other words, if a Hittite king had come down and conquered another city that hadn't belonged to him, he might have written a covenant, a treaty with that other nation or with that city. And really within that treaty, and they found evidence of these treaties, and they follow all the same kind of structure. It starts off initially with an introduction which runs something like this: I'm King whoever, and I'm great, and I've come and conquered your city, and I've done this and done that. And it's initially an overview of his greatness and perhaps the gods that he claimed to serve and their help to him in conquering the city. Then he would set out what were his requirements. You shall do this, you shall do this. The prerequisites that he was placing upon the people that he was now claiming to be their king. And then following that, he would say, now, if you don't do it, well, here are the curses. And if you do it, here's the benefits. There weren't always very many benefits. It was generally always all about cursings. And then at the end, he would call to witness his gods, and there would be this formal treaty, a covenant. This city that he had conquered had effectively agreed now to the terms of this treaty. And so often people say, well, Deuteronomy is really just a copy of that, the same structure. You have God initially laying claim to be the king, if you like, the sovereign of the nation. And he sets out his credentials and why he has a right to be king. And then he sets forward in chapter 5, thou shalt do this and thou shalt not do this, and so on. And then there's a section in Deuteronomy that deals with the blessings that follow if you obey and the cursings that follow if you don't. And then there's a section that deals with the witness, God calling upon the nation and upon God to witness the terms of the treaty, the covenant. But that would be to completely undersell really the heart of this book. Because the great difference, of course, is this: when the kings made the treaties in those far off days, there was never any concern about people loving the king, obeying out of love, or wanting to walk with the king. And yet this book, as Moses is going to present it from God himself, as God enjoins upon the people, he's going to tell them, I want you must love the Lord your God with all your heart and your mind and your soul and so on. And it's not merely just slavish fear that God was wanting. He wanted them to love him. And there are at least 20 plus references to the word love in Deuteronomy. There's 45 references to the heart of man. And so Moses now, as he preaches, which is what is different now, this isn't merely a cold treaty. And perhaps this was where my misconception of Deuteronomy was. Repeating the law, I thought that sounds like just a cold sort of legal document, but it's not that. This is coming, I suppose, not only from the heart of Moses, but from the very heart of God himself, as he repeats the terms of the covenant to this new generation who were going to go into a land where there'd be temptations that they'd never faced before. Imagine for a moment these people, they had never been in business. They'd just been nomads for 40 years. They'd never dealt really with nations other than from time to time they came across them in their wanderings. They'd never set up farms. They'd never enjoyed the land in that sense. That they'd always just had to rely on the manna day after day. And now they were going to have fields and barns, and they were going to come across nations that had temples and idols and that believed in multiple gods, polytheism, and so on. And so there was a great deal then of temptation and trial that would lie on the other side of the Jordan. How would God, therefore, want to address these people in order to maintain their or hold their loyalty to him? As you come then just to look at the book, one of the things that strikes you, and I'll move fairly quickly through this, is that it sounds an awful lot at times like New Testament writing. In fact, you'd nearly think the way that Moses goes about it is very similar to the way Paul went about it. Or if I could put it this way, it nearly seems like Paul used Moses' pattern of preaching. Because when you read through Deuteronomy, the way that Moses goes about trying to get this over to the people is this. He'll say, now look, God is like this. And God has done this. And he presents to them theology. He presents to them the character of God. And we're going to look at that in a moment. But the structure runs something like this. Because God is like this, therefore, and there's going to be multiple uses of this word therefore all the way through Deuteronomy, but it runs on this basis, just like you would imagine Paul writing Romans, setting out all of the great theology that presents in the first 11 chapters that there are in Romans. And then he says, therefore, and it is the same kind of structure through Deuteronomy. Moses then presents God to the nation. He reminds them of what God's like. And then he's going to say, therefore, love the Lord your God with all your heart. Walk with the Lord. Fear him. And all of the conditions that apply to them, it's on the basis of what you know of God. And so he presents to them God. And I want to show you from chapter 4, at least just taking one small section of Deuteronomy, to see some of the things that Moses brings before the people. In fact, just before we do that, I want you to look at chapter 6, a very well-known verse, in verse 4. And Moses says to them, hear, O Israel, the Lord our God is one Lord. Now, there's quite a lot of debate even amongst all of the theologians about precisely what this phrase actually means, and in particular the last one, the Lord our God is one Lord. Now, just to put before you, there's a number of different ways of looking at this sense of it being one. One as opposed to polytheism, where there were the hundreds of gods that the nations bowed down to. So it could be one in that sense of a singular. But it can also be taken in the sense of unique. In other words, one and only Lord. He is unique, not just singular, but uniquely singular. Uniquely different from everything else that you could imagine. God is unique. And I think in that sense, in particular, is the way then that Moses now, in chapter 4, he's going to remind them of what God is like and what God has done, the uniqueness of God. And I want to just point out some things very simply as we go through chapter 4. And look at verse 5. He says, behold, I have taught you statutes and judgments, even as the Lord my God commanded me that ye should do so in the land, whither you go to possess it. Keep therefore and do them, for this is your wisdom and your understanding in the sight of the nations, which shall hear all these statutes and say, surely this great nation is a wise and understanding people. For what nation is there so great who hath God so nigh unto them as the Lord our God is in all things that we call upon him for? Now notice he then says in verse 10, he says, I particularly want to remind you, especially the day that thou stoodest before the Lord thy God in Horeb, when the Lord said unto me, gather me the people together, and I will make them hear my words. I want you to start to think just for a moment about the uniqueness of the nearness, the intimacy of the God of Israel. The nations around them, although they had their pantheon of gods, they never had any sense in which they knew what the mind of those gods were. They were remote, entirely distant. You couldn't really get to know them. They were unapproachable in their minds. They lived in some distant world, a realm where really they were almost had to try to get their attention by doing things, offering gifts, and the more attention they tried to raise, the better chance they felt they had of getting the notice of their gods. You'll find that particularly if you think about the story of Elijah and Mount Carmel. You remember he Elijah almost mocks the prophets of Baal, doesn't he? And he says, maybe Baal he can't hear you. You know, just speak a little louder, fellows. And or maybe he's gone on a distant journey. Maybe he's gone to the bathroom, or maybe he's asleep, or he's taken a walk, or whatever it was. And he says, look, you need to do more to try to attract your God's attention, as though the gods were uninterested in them. And I want to stop just to think of the marvel of this. As Moses is going to tell them, look, when you go into that land, don't be ashamed now of what happened at Mount Sinai. The transcendent Lord came down. And as Moses says to them, what nation is there so great who hath God so nigh unto them? Brethren and sisters, stop and think about the wonder of this for the moment. The great eternal creator God came down and revealed his mind and his heart to a little nation of slaves. The wonder of it, that God would come down to speak to man. And Moses says, think about the uniqueness of God, the God who's drawn near, the God who's spoken to us. But he reminds them too about the righteousness of the God whom they serve, the uniqueness of his righteousness and the righteousness of his statutes in particular. You'll notice in verse 6, he says, keep therefore and do them. This is your wisdom and your understanding in the sight of the nations, which shall hear all these statutes and say, surely this great nation is a wise and understanding people. Verse 8, and what nation is there so great that has statutes and judgments so righteous as all this law? You see the point what he's making is this. When you go into that land and they tell you they have all their laws and they have their gods, don't you be ashamed of your wisdom and understanding. What does he mean by that? Well, what he means by that is this. There was tremendous wisdom and understanding in the law that God gave them. Just think for a moment what lies at the heart of the law. The first thing was this, obviously, man's respect towards God, that God was unique in those early commands. But then also the respect that man should have to his fellow man. And in the law in particular, God raises the dignity of humanity, lifts up man and says, in effect, man was made in the image of God. Therefore, you don't steal from a man. You don't commit adultery and take another man's wife. You don't murder. You don't covet what he has. Man was made in the image of God. I perhaps hesitantly say, brethren and sisters, we live in a world which has lost a sense of the dignity of the humanity of man. I was amazed to read. I looked up the statistics the other day. In our country alone, 200,000 babies are aborted every year. 200,000, only 600,000 are born. 200,000 are aborted. Might we hear the words of Moses? Don't be ashamed at the laws of God. Don't be ashamed at a God that upholds the dignity of humanity. And in his laws, he keeps it sanctified. But more, not just the nearness of God and the righteousness of God. He's going to speak about the jealousy of God. But I want you to come down to verse 24. He says, for the Lord thy God is a consuming fire, even a jealous God. That might seem a strange thing to us. It might seem like a negative on the attributes of God. But when Moses is thinking about the jealousy of God here, what he's saying is this, because God is one and unique, he demands our entire heart and soul and mind. He doesn't share it with a pantheon. Imagine the, if you like, the very folly of pantheonism. How do you divide your attention to the 200, 300 gods that there is? Do you have a day for one god and another day for another god? Or do you have to choose which day you serve? He says, God is a jealous God. And Israel, when you go over the Jordan and you're confronted by the worship of polytheism and all the multitude of gods, remember that God is jealous. He demands your entire affection and your heart. Our God is a jealous God, a consuming fire. Then come down. You can think about his judgments. He speaks now in verse 25, when thou shalt beget children, and he goes down and he says in verse 27, the Lord shall scatter you among the nations. He's actually foreseeing now the fact that the nation will fail. And he says, God will judge you. They are a part, aren't they, of the attributes of God, God's judgments. He says, God will judge you. Verse 27, the Lord shall scatter you among the nations. Ye shall be left few in number among the heathen, whither the Lord shall lead you. And there ye shall serve gods, the work of men's hands, wood and stone. He reminds them now of what's going to happen when they forsake him, and exactly what does happen, and really culminates eventually in the nation being carried away into captivity. First of all, the northern tribes, as you know, into Assyria, and then the southern tribes to Babylon under Nebuchadnezzar. He says, you'll end up going back to worshiping graven images. You'll end up being slaves again. I took you out of slavery, but the consequences of forsaking me will be that you will ultimately end up back in slavery itself. The judgment of God. I want you to notice the mercy of God. Look at verse 29. But if from thence thou shalt seek the Lord thy God, thou shalt find him. If thou seek him with all thy heart, with all thy soul, when thou art in tribulation, and all these things are come upon thee, even in the latter days, if thou turn to the Lord thy God, thou shalt be obedient unto his voice. For the Lord thy God is a merciful God. He will not forsake thee, neither destroy thee. You know, somebody has called Deuteronomy the gospel according to Moses. And I would have shown my complete ignorance to think that there were such wonderful truths as this. Moses foresees the failure of the nation that, as I said, would eventually end up being carried away into captivity. But he says, look, if you turn, I know the character of God. I know the very heart of God. If you turn with all your heart, God is a merciful God, and God will restore you again. Then he talks then about the faithfulness of God, faithfulness to his covenant. He says that at the end of verse 31. He says, nor forget the covenant. God will not forget the covenant of thy fathers, which he sware unto them. You know, when you come to Romans chapter 11, the basis on which the nation of Israel will be brought into blessing, one of the reasons that Paul gives in Romans chapter 11, he says it's for the father's sake. And God is faithful. God made promises to Abraham and Isaac and Jacob. And God intends to fulfill them, and he will fulfill them. That's part of his character. You can see what Moses is doing down through this chapter. He's reminding the people of the attributes of God that they're going to serve when they go into Canaan. He goes on to speak about his patience with them. And I want you to come down then. He says, verse 37, and he says, and because he loved thy fathers, therefore, he chose their seed after them and brought thee out in his sight with his mighty power out of Egypt. He speaks about the love of God. I want you to come over to chapter 7 quickly just to pick up as he repeats again this theme of the love of God. And he says in verse 6, for thou art a holy people unto the Lord thy God. The Lord thy God hath chosen thee to be a special people unto himself above all people that are upon the face of the earth. The Lord did not set his love upon you, nor choose you, because you were more in number than any people. For you were the fewest of all people, but because the Lord loved you. Now, it's lovely, isn't it? What effectively Moses says, he says this, he loved you because he loved you. He loved you not because you were mighty, not because you were great. And he's going to say in chapter 4, he says, have you ever heard of a nation? Have you ever heard of a God who chose a nation out of another nation? he's going to speak really in a sense about the sovereignty of God and the love of God together. His love for them based purely upon his own volition, his choice of the nation of Israel. He loved them because he loved them. And then I want you to think just for a moment about the objective that he had. And this again makes him unique. It makes him completely, and this whole book, entirely different from the treaties, the human treaties, where the intention, the heart of the king that had conquered a city was just simply to rule as a dictator over them. And you know that people have this, particularly atheists have this view of the God of the Old Testament, just as some despotic leader that orders the destructions of nations willy-nilly. If you were to come now to the very heart of this covenant, why did God choose Israel? Why did he bring them out? What was his purpose of bringing them out of Egypt? I want to remind you of the words in Exodus chapter 19 that the Lord says to Moses. He says, Moses, you tell them, you remind them, I brought you on eagle's wings. I delivered you out of Egypt and brought you on eagle's wings that I might bring you unto myself. You know, Canaan wasn't the ultimate goal of redemption for the nation of Israel. God's ultimate goal for the nation of Israel was to bring them to himself. He goes on to say in chapter 19, they're going to be my peculiar treasure. And as you listen to these words and you think about it, it reminds you more of almost the language of somebody wooing maybe a potential bride. And for some of the men on the call, you might remember it well. You plucked up the courage one day, perhaps just to invite a certain young lady to for a cup of coffee or maybe a meal. And, you know, you polished the car and you got your best clothes on and you hoovered the car like it had never been hoovered before. In fact, my wife still reminds me of that. That the first time I ever picked her up in the car, she had never seen my car so spotless and never again. And she also reminds me that it was the one and only time I ever opened the door for her when she got in. Well, you're trying to woo her. And listen to God as he's trying to woo the nation. He says, I delivered you. I brought you out. I want you to be my peculiar treasure. I have set my love upon you. He says, it's not too much to ask now, is it, for you to obey me and to walk in my statutes, to do what I've asked you to do. But you say, was it all one way, this relationship? Well, if you know, and I'm going to address now the ladies, and or maybe some of the gentlemen might, that if there's a husband and wife listening together, you might just, the husband might be inclined to say, you know, it wasn't all one way, was it? I know you acted as though, you know, it was all the man leading and that. But I do remember you turned up at the odd meeting here and there where I didn't expect to find you. Was that just by accident? Or did you come after me as well? Was it not a little bit both ways at least? Do you remember in Jeremiah chapter 2, God says to the nation, I remember the love of thine espousals. I remember when you went after me in the wilderness. I remember your love for me. Brethren and sisters, stop for a moment to think of the wonder of this, the eternal God delighting in the love of these slaves that went after him in the wilderness. And listen to his lament at the end of chapter 2. But you've forsaken me and gone after gods that were no gods at all. And you've forsaken the living God. Well, you wonder how it could have all gone wrong then. With Moses' great exposition of theology and the greatness of God, he enjoins upon them the people that they might love the Lord their God. And God having wooed them and God having demonstrated his love to them and his faithfulness and his mercy, and all of these things, you would say, how did they ever go astray? Well, Moses actually predicts it in this book, as we've seen. And I want you to read one verse in chapter 10 where he sums up the requirements on the people. And he says in verse 16, circumcise therefore the foreskin of your heart and be no more stiff-necked. He repeats the same phrase again in chapter 30, that if only their hearts were circumcised. Now, you're surprised, aren't you, to find this in Deuteronomy, in a book that's all about law. Moses is going to say this, the very source of the problem is going to be in the hearts of the people. And the great need will be that their heart is circumcised, that they have a new heart, that they truly love the Lord their God with all their heart. And right through this book, time and time again, he's going to bring up the nature of their heart. But if you know then anything about the New Testament and the New Covenant, I want you just now, as I close in these final moments, to read what lies at the heart of the New Covenant. And I want to read from Hebrews chapter 8 and verse 6. Hebrews chapter 8, verse 6, the writer says, but now hath he obtained a more excellent ministry, by how much more also he is the mediator of a better covenant, which was established upon better promise. I do want you to notice something as we go past. He says it was established. It has been established, the new covenant. It is in force. It is in operation. It says, then the fault lieth, verse 7, for if that first covenant had been faultless, then should no place have been sought for the second. Well, what was the fault then? Well, he says, for finding fault with them, he said, behold, the days come, saith the Lord, when I will make a new covenant with the house of Israel and with the house of Judah, not according to the covenant that I made with their fathers in the day when I took them by the hand to lead them out of the land of Egypt, because they continued not in my covenant, and I regarded them not, saith the Lord. In other words, the problem was this, the people continued not. They began well under the days of Joshua, but they continued not. And so that raises a question then, how will God ever get people to continue? How will he get you and I to continue in our steadfast loyalty to him? What will the new covenant now offer? Well, it goes on to talk about the terms of this new covenant. Verse 10, for this is the covenant that I will make with the house of Israel after those days, saith the Lord. I will put my laws into their mind and write them in their hearts, and I will be to them a God, and they shall be to me a people. Verse 12, for I will be merciful to their unrighteousness, and their sins and their iniquities will I remember no more. In that he saith a new covenant, he hath made the first old. Now, my time is gone. I just want to say a couple of things. And the first is this. I appreciate that there's a lot of difference amongst scholars that are far more knowledgeable than me about whether we are part of the new covenant. And I don't obviously have time tonight to go into all of that. Having thought about all of the different arguments, I appreciate that in Jeremiah, it does say that it's made with the house of Israel and with Judah. But when I come to the New Testament and I listen to, for example, in 1 Corinthians chapter 11, and I listen to the words of the Lord in the upper room as he institutes what we call the Lord's Supper, he refers to the New Covenant and the verses that we've read here even that suggest very clearly that the New Covenant is in operation. I can't come to any other conclusion than that you and I are included in some way. You might think differently, but if that's the case, then I want to think for a moment now as we close what it means to us. If you were to have asked those young people as they perhaps left that meeting that Moses was preaching, and you asked them a question, you said, look, I noticed when Moses said about Mount Sinai, he said that covenant was made with you. But you weren't there, were you? You're only 25. You weren't there. Well, they would say, well, no, we weren't, but we were. Because when God made that covenant, he was looking beyond the generation there that was standing at Mount Sinai. And we were there as much as they were there. And I ask you a question as I close now. Were you there in the upper room when the Lord took the bread? And when he took the cup, were you there? Or in the words of that old hymn, were you there? When they nailed my Lord, when they crucified my Lord, were you there? Were you there when they nailed him to the tree? Were you there? Does it mean anything to us? If it does, we need to understand its terms. You say it's a wonderful thing. He says, their sins and iniquities will I remember no more. And we all say, praise God about that. But there's another part. And perhaps every Lord's Day when we take the cup, we ought to remember what those terms of that new covenant was. For God says, I'm going to write my law upon their heart. And we need to examine our hearts, don't we? And wonder if we have a heart that God might write his laws upon. That we really have a heart to love him, to obey him, to love his law, and to enjoy all that he's given us.